Hi there. This is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and very happy to be here. This Friday night, I have a very, very interesting guest this evening, William Stocker, and I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing his name right. William, are you on the line with me?
Yeah, I am here. It's pronounced Stecker, William Stecker.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah,
you've written this book called Atlantis Conspiracy, and you're someone who seems to be connecting the dots going way back to the time of Atlantis, and I think that it will be very fascinating to discuss all of that with you. And we will start off with all of that in just a moment. I just want to make a couple of quick announcements here. First of all, I want to let everyone know that I will not be going to Australia in the next week or so, even though I was hoping and planning to do so. Basically, we couldn't secure the venues soon enough. There just wasn't enough time to get all our ducks in a row. And so we are going to move that trip to, looks like, sometime near the end of September, maybe, or end of October, one of those dates, and we're looking at the dates right now and going to have more time to organize things. So anyone from Australia who's listening, I'm sorry for the delay, and we were really hoping to be able to squeeze everything in, but it kind of got away from us. We had so much response from so many cities that we did want to just go and just do one or two venues, and we couldn't get the venues set up quick enough, and there's just, when you do conferences, live conferences, as you can appreciate, there's just so much that goes on behind the scenes. So I just wanted to make that announcement. And other than that, let me see. Oh, well, I want to direct everyone, first of all, to the chat room that is going on. And if you go to my front page on projectcamelotportal.com or projectcamelot.org, which will take you to the same place, you can click on the chat button near the radio icon and join the chat room if you're interested, and you can also ask questions during the show there. And I believe we also have the means by which you can call in to Revolution Radio at some point, and we can also take calls during the show. The other thing to be aware of, if you're not already doing so, is that, first of all, we have a newsletter. And you can sign up for that if you go to my blog, which I also want to direct people to anyway, because I've just made some recent posts, some very interesting posts, and been talking to some people behind the scenes about revolutionary acts, as it were, and what's a good thing to do to change this country. And so I do want to direct people to my blog. And then if you could also sign up for the newsletter, we have sent out a new newsletter just recently, and in fact, we've just finished sending it out. And so we are doing a live stream event that is going to be on Wednesday, the 18th, which is next Wednesday, at, 11 a.m. Pacific time. And it is going to be at 11 a.m. because we are going to be interviewing Mr. Keshe, who is a nuclear physicist. He now lives, Iranian nuclear physicist who now lives in Belgium and is involved in what he calls the Keshe Foundation. And he is going to be talking about new energy technology, plasma reactors, and so on, interstellar travel, and all kinds of great stuff. So that should be a lot of fun. So I want to encourage everyone to join us. That will be a free event. Again, donation requested but not required. So I guess without further ado, let's talk to William Stecker, who has been on the line here holding and being very patient. William, could you start off by giving a bit of your background? I know that you were a writer for Atlantis Rising. Is that the name of the publication?
Right. Yeah, I've been with them every issue, a full-length article, and sometimes a letter to the editor as well for well over almost 2.5 years now.
Okay.
One of the regular team on that.
Wonderful. And then on top of it, you've got your own book out there, which is called The Atlantis Conspiracy, and I want to encourage everyone to purchase that book. I have purchased it, although it hasn't arrived yet, so I haven't been able to read it prior to the show, and I apologize, but I'm very interested to read it. But in terms of your background, you actually did have a background in sort of the intelligence area initially, right?
Yeah, I'll give you the whole rundown. I mean, I'm 68 years old, retired from my day job. My wife is retired as well, and we're presently living in Sacramento. And what happened, I'm probably the only person you're ever going to talk to, I would think, who's had a UFO-type abduction encounter experience and who's also been an Air Force intelligence officer and has an additional duty, because it was taken out of intelligence by regulation change. As a junior officer, of course, I had a lot of additional duties. I was a UFO investigator for the Air Force back in 67, 68, 66, 67, 68, in fact, when there were quite a few sightings. And Project Blue Book was still operating. Major Hector Quintanilla, whom you may have read about, was in charge of it. So that's a pretty unique set of experiences. I think the thing that's the strangest, though, is that following my abduction experience at age 11 as a child, over a period of many years, I had what I call repeated close encounters of the worst kind, two that I know of, with some very sinister people from the government that popped up in positions of authority over me. And it took me a long time to even begin to figure out what was going on. And this was just one of the many factors that led me to writing the book and also now, of course, a lot of magazine articles.
Okay, well, that's a very leading statement. I guess I want to decipher it slightly. What you're saying is that, first of all, to back up a little bit, you were abducted as a child, but then as you kind of matured and you joined the Air Force, you actually were tasked with doing something similar to J. Allen Hynek, it sounds like. You were sort of a UFO investigator?
Yeah, just down at a local level, not up at his level like that. What happened was I was an Air Force ROTC cadet, and I was commissioned in June of 65, went on active duty in September of 65, and was assigned to NORAD, North American Air Defense Command. At that time, the Air Force's component of it was ADC, Air Defense Command, which no longer exists. Initially, I was put into radar weapons control, a very technical thing to talk about. I could explain in detail if you want, but it would make your head spin. And I was totally inept at that. I mean, to be very honest and upfront, I flunked out of that career field. I couldn't do radar weapons control at all. So they put me into intelligence for NORAD, and it turned out I had a real aptitude for that and did quite well as an intelligence officer. Now, originally, UFO investigations was under AFR, Air Force Regulation 200-2, an intelligence series regulation. But the Air Force wanted to get away from the cloak and dagger aspect that tended to give it. So they changed it. They rescinded AFR 200-2 and put UFO investigation under AFR, Air Force Regulation 80-17, Research and Development Series Regulation. But in actual practice, every base back then would have a designated junior officer, usually, who would be as an additional duty to his regular duties, the UFO investigator. So I retained that duty.
That's very interesting to hear that the Air Force would actually assign, you're saying, officers to this type of duty, even though at that time they weren't really publicly acknowledging that UFOs existed, right?
No, they wouldn't acknowledge that they were anything other than, weather balloons and so forth, but they were investigating, and it was quite open. This is Project Blue Book. It was never a secret that they were doing this. In addition to AFR 8017, we also had JANAP, J-A-N-A-P, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication, JANAP 146. I wanted to mention that because some people have denied that ever existed, but I had a copy in my office. And JANAP 146 primarily dealt with pilot or aircrew reports of anything out of the ordinary. It could be a UFO, a meteor, a Soviet aircraft over American airspace, anything. So we had those two regulations, and then I investigated UFOs subject to those. And sent Intel-type reports, we actually never used the term Project Blue Book, although I knew that's what it was called. I would send Intel-type reports to FTD, Foreign Technology Division of HATIC, ATIC, Air Technical Intelligence Command, I believe it was. It's been a long time.
I get that. But you know, it's fascinating that you did that. And I could actually ask you a zillion questions in this regard, because the politics of what went down with Blue Book is a fascinating story in and of itself, having, interviewed Ann Eller, who worked with Hynek and heard that whole story from that angle. And also, I'm good friends with Rich Dolan, and I guess you probably know about Rich's work, right?
Well, this is an interesting story. I've met Rich Dolan on several occasions. I go to all these conferences. Vicki Jack used to do the UFO conference in Santa Clara until she kind of self-destructed. I knew her, and Ruben Uriarte is a good friend of mine, and I've met Rich Dolan many times there at the conferences. And I also know Brian Hall, who does a conspiracy conference, and I've been going to those for a long time. The interesting thing about Richard Dolan is that in his book, UFOs and the National Security State, one of the cases in his book is about two people from the University of Colorado UFO project under Dr. Condon, who was authorized by the Air Force to actually, it was a cover-up. I mean, Condon was into covering up the whole thing. The Air Force wanted to get rid of it, wash their hands of it. So supposedly it was an open-minded assessment of UFOs by these people. And, the project sent Dr. Norman Levine and Mr. John Ahrens to Duluth International Airport, where there was a NORAD base at that time. It's not there anymore. That's where I was stationed at that time, to investigate a possible double radar sighting, a sighting where one radar picked up the UFOs and possibly another radar did at the same time. If that were the case, you'd know something was out there. Again, I could get into the technical aspects of it if you want to, but it would bother some people. They probably would have some problems with it, but I could do that. But anyway, we weren't able to establish that. And Richard Dolan talks about this incident in his book, although he doesn't mention me. And so I was actually involved in the incident in his book, and I've talked to him about it, but he promptly forgot all about me. Last time I met him, I didn't even look familiar to him, so...
Oh, well, I'm very sorry to hear that because,
No big deal. He's always a great guy. He's always very decent and courteous to everyone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's a lovely man. And I guess he's just, been inundated, of course, by facts, chasing down all the stories. But, I'm sure he would have wanted to recall and perhaps even get your testimony on that, in that regard. So what you're saying is that you were involved in that particular incident. And the incident itself or what was surrounding it was a cover-up. Are you saying the incident was real, but then there was a cover-up put into place?
I don't think there's any cover-up of that particular incident. We just weren't able to get the tapes because they didn't keep them that long from the big, they call them search radars, that fed into the SAE, Semi-Automatic Ground Environment Direction Center, and the computers to establish that the search radars picked up the objects. They were picked up by a RAPCON radar approach control, which is a short range radar with a very fast 5-second sweep to guide aircraft in the final approach and take off and that sort of thing. And so we weren't able to establish that there was a second radar. There was no cover up that I know of in that case.
Okay, but there was an incident. In other words, there was a sighting, is what you're saying.
Oh yeah, it's radar sighting, entirely in radar.
Okay, and I mean, can you describe, just because we happen to be talking about it, and God knows we have enough else to talk about, but I just what was it exactly? What was the craft?
Well, over, I think it was through St. Marie, Michigan area, there was a radar approach control, RAPCON, and the RAPCON operators picked up several objects moving about 2,000 miles per hour that just went right across the area really fast. And that was all there was to it. There was no visual sighting, just the radar.
Okay, well, but you weren't able to...
It really wasn't that fascinating, the case. It's just that it was odd that, it was in the book.
Okay, but just your role was what? Being one of the people that spotted it, or...?
No, I was just the intelligence officer, and as an additional duty, the UFO investigator... at the NORAD headquarters, the 2930 Division of Duluth International Airport, where we had our semi-automatic ground environment direction center, which is just a NORAD air defense center with a lot of computers. And Dr. Levine and Mr. Ahrens had to visit our big direction center to look for tapes or evidence of the search radars that picked it up. And that was my only role in that case. The only thing I did was to escort them into and around the building and out again.
Oh, interesting.
It was really limited. Yeah.
Okay.
Limited.
I see.
But it was a secure area, and they couldn't just go in and walk around without a security badge.
All right. And so let me ask you this. What was your sort of level of secrecy? What was your classified status at any one time? How deep did you go?
Well, I had a top secret clearance, but you got to understand that doesn't mean what some people might imagine. That didn't mean that I was, you know, on all sorts of cosmic secrets and could go on any base and see stickers, Air Force intelligence, give me all your top secret files. There's something called need to know. And the only top secret files that I was allowed to see was some information on the Soviet LRA AOB. That's a long range aviation, the Soviet equivalent during the Cold War of SAC, a strategic air command. And AOB means air order battle. So it was a very limited amount of top secret material that I would see. I had quite a bit of secret material that I dealt with from a number of sources.
Okay. All right. Well, gosh, you know, I'm sorry here because I'm kind of torn in which direction to go with you. I know you've written your book and you've obviously...
I've written a lot of directions. I can talk. See, I've researched so many articles.
Right.
On so many topics, Atlantis, UFOs, Face on Mars, and I've had that whole series of experiences. So I can talk about any or all of these things.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Your experience, you said, was not entirely positive, and it sounded like you were referring to having the military involved in it.
Yeah, if you want to talk about the series of experiences I had, I should probably begin with the abduction. If you know, and then you can cut me off at any time if you think it's taking.
Sure. All right.
Okay. Well, to begin with, I was 11 years old. And this experience resembles in many, not all regards, contemporary accounts of UFO abductions. I was 11 years old in 1955 at a school-sponsored summer camp at Garner State Park in the Texas Hill Country, perhaps, I don't know, roughly 100 miles or so, roughly west or southwest of San Antonio. And we boys slept on cots and tents, furnishing our own bedding, in my case, a thick cotton summer sleeping bag. My cot at the front of the tent, it was perhaps the 34th town from the end of a row, roughly paralleling the Frio River. And beyond the last tent was partly open, partly wooded countryside, extending, I don't know, a couple of hundred yards maybe, it's been a while, to a fence that ran down perpendicular to the river. Beyond the fence was more partly open, partly wooded country, not true wilderness. It was a state park with hiking and riding trails, but, you know, in the witching hours after midnight when I'm pretty sure this happened, it would be pretty much deserted. And I went to sleep one night, and all seemed well, and then everything changed forever. I didn't ask for this, but I got it. Because I found myself with no transition, no sense of how I came to be there, no longer in my tent. I was standing barefooted, sleeping bag slung over my shoulder in the dark, starry night, by that fence, some distance from the camp. And I was in the most curious state of consciousness I've ever been in. It wasn't like being asleep or being awake or in a dream. It was different from anything. I was completely fearless. I had absolutely no fear. I should have been terrified. And I was absolutely calm. And unfortunately, I'm not a calm person. I'm a type A personality, very judgmental, often angry, always in a hurry. But that night, I was incredibly calm. And I was not alone. More or less surrounding me, so far as I could see, were several individuals. And I don't recall their exact appearance. They were either fully human in appearance, maybe they were human. I don't know. They would have had to have had some rather strange powers, if that's the case, or humanoid, if you will. And no words were spoken, not even a voice in my head, but there was a powerful sense of being questioned, of being tested in some manner. Now, decades later, I suspect they may also have imparted to me some knowledge or some secret or teaching. You don't go to an 11-year-old boy in 1955 and say, hey, kid, here's the secrets of the universe. Make a note of it. That wouldn't have worked too well. But if you have the kind of powers I mentioned, you might implant a sort of psychic seed or subliminal suggestion in the mind, perhaps reinforcing interests or tendencies that are already present. Look here, seek there, think about this, consider that, over a lifetime leading to some changes in consciousness. And then, again with no transition, I found myself walking back toward the tents and beginning to return to my normal state of consciousness. And I'm making noise now on this, so I know you're still there. We haven't lost the connection.
No, I'm definitely here, and I'm just listening for everything.
But anyway, I looked over my shoulder, and a few yards behind me was the fence. But I could see no one. I seemed to be alone. And I didn't really look up in the sky, so I don't know if there was a craft up there, but I have no memory of being in a craft or a lighted interior or even in a cave, although we were in a limestone cave area, which might be significant. And I made my way back to my tent, and it was blocked by a patch of burrs, which are spiny-seeded plants they have in Texas where everything has sharp points on it. And I threw my sleeping bag on them, walked on it, picked it up, threw it on my cot, climbed in, and incredibly went to sleep. In the morning, I found dirt and burrs adhering to the outside of my bag, proof at least to my satisfaction that at least I was physically out there. And, there's no one you can tell about an experience like that, certainly not back in 1955. I think I told one other kid at summer camp whom I didn't even know back home in Houston, and he would probably have forgotten it. He suggested maybe big kids had carried me out there as a prank or something, but every explanation, so-called logical or conventional explanation I try to come up with falls short for a whole lot of reasons. On top of everything else, what protected my feet walking out there in the dark? It's the birds, and there's broken glass and cactus and rattlesnakes and everything else. It's like something protected me. Now, 8 years after that, in 1963, just before they killed Kennedy, I returned to New Mexico State University in Las Cruces to begin my junior year as a college history major and Air Force ROTC cadet. And I found that our ROTC detachment there at New Mexico State had a new senior instructor, second in command, Air Force Major Francis Cunyon, wearing on his Air Force uniform an Army paratrooper badge or jump wings. And he explained to us cadets that back in the early 50s, now I may have told Richard Boylan that the guy was in the unit in 51 or 52, I couldn't remember, but for a number of reasons I'm quite certain it was 1953, even though I can't remember him exactly what he told us. He had joined this tiny little spec ops parachute qualified Air Force intelligence unit whose members, he said, were trained and configured to parachute on the crashed Soviet aircraft, either if they were here on peacetime reconnaissance or in the event of World War III, to capture crew members for interrogation, get the black boxes, which are actually orange, gather intelligence. Pretty harebrained idea, but I was young and naive, and I believed them. Now, this is a unit that author and researcher Kevin Randall, I'm sure you've heard of Kevin Randall, has written an article and a full-length book about. And in the book, he has a whole lot of Freedom of Information Act, photocopies of documents received from the government. And the book is called Project Moondust. And Kevin Randall has established, and I've seen his documents in there, there's no question about it, in the government's own words, this was a UFO crash retrieval unit. So to recap, up to now, I have a UFO-type experience, essentially tell no one. And yet, 8 years later, a former member, in fact, one of the earliest members and one of the earliest leaders, not the top leader, but as a lieutenant at that time, he was a lieutenant back in 53, he would have been one of the subordinate leaders, is appointed directly over me. And I would submit to you that we've already pushed coincidence way out of bounds, and I haven't even gotten to the scary part. I went on in ROTC, and in the fall semester of my senior year, 1964, I was sent for a routine pre-commissioning physical. Nothing unusual about that. We were roughly equidistant from Biggs Air Force Base in El Paso and Holloman Air Force Base in Alamogordo. And maybe you can guess what's coming next, where I went. It was Holloman. And, of course, you're familiar with the stories. There's a lot of them. I don't know what to think of them. But Holloman was kind of like Area 51 before there was an Area 51. And there are an awful lot of really scary stories about it. I don't know if they're true or disinformation or what.
Okay, well, we're about to go to break, but I want to know why you're calling them scary stories. What was scary about it?
It was the encounters later on that I had, but the stories about Holloman, I mean, they're talking about people being taken away to other planets, and then there are stories of presidents meeting with aliens. And for me, that's a little disturbing.
Okay. Back then, were you when you found out you were working with this guy who was over you in your college years, I guess, the ROTC, did the coincidence occur to you then, or is this something you thought about?
I didn't suspect anything at all then. I believed his story that he was aircraft crash retrieval team. I didn't give no thought to UFOs. I didn't give any thought to my experience at age 11.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio. We'll be right back after this short break, so stay tuned.
I know it's been 48 years since you received physical, but the thing that bothers me is I clearly remember the entire conversation in the car driving over there. After Sergeant Gregg was riding out of the right front seat, another cadet in the left rear.
Okay, hold on here. We've got a break coming on. So if you, we'll be right back with William Stoker.
Okay.
And thank you very much.
Well, I'm not sure what happened to that break. Well, welcome back, folks. This is Kerry Cassidy's show, Whistleblowers Radio. Are you there, Kerry? I think she's still gone on break. Remember, folks, this is...
Okay, I'm here.
Welcome
okay.
back.
Thank you. Okay, well, so should I go ahead here?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, all right. Thank you. So, William, where we left off, you were talking about actually what you called Holloman Air Force Base and various, you know, incidents that you'd been hearing about, and you were calling them frightening from various perspectives. So what I wanted to do is find out at that point, like, because you're telling the story as you know it now, but your frame of mind where you were at that time was that it was a scary time for you?
Not at that time. It's now I'm looking back at that time. At the time, I didn't suspect anything. And what bothers me about this, and probably I don't want to make too much of this Holloman thing because probably nothing happened. It's been 48 years, but I could so clearly remember the entire conversation in the car. I remember driving in the front gate, and I remember Sergeant Gregg making some crack about the security policeman. I remember driving down this tree-lined street, and then bang, I don't remember anything. Next thing I know, I'm back in class at New Mexico State University. And who remembers routine physicals 48 years later? Just what bothers me is I remember everything else so clearly. And as I say, at the time, that never bothered me. It's just now that I've heard all these stories about Holloman that I can't help but wonder, did something happen there? But I'll probably never know.
Okay, so you don't remember the physical, is what you're saying?
I don't remember anything driving down that tree-lined street and then bang, nothing.
Well, that actually, that's very interesting. Do you know who Robert Salas is?
Yes.
Okay, have you ever met him in person?
I'm trying to remember, there's two or three of these guys. Is he that little Austrian guy?
No, Robert Salas, no, you're thinking about Michael Sala. Robert
Salas. Okay, yeah, I've heard this guy too. Yeah, I haven't met him. I've heard him.
Well, he's the one who talks about the Minuteman missiles in the Montana, I believe, area.
Yeah, right. I have read those. I have
the shutdown, and he wrote a book. The name of the book is not coming to mind, but he's a wonderful witness in this area, and I interviewed him a long time ago, even before Project Camelot, and then put my interview with him sort of late up on the web. And at one point he was talking about going to a physical when he was in the military. And it was after he had, this incident, with the Minuteman missiles, I believe. And, he had the same experience. In other words,
he went
physical and he did not recall what happened. So I don't think that's just two of you speaking like that, but it's an interesting dynamic, and it sounds like there might be something there. So I take it you've never been regressed.
Nobody's been able to hypnotize me. Dr. Boylan tried to in 1992, but he couldn't hypnotize me.
Uh-huh. Okay, and so at this point, you went through that experience, but you didn't actually remember having anything happen in that place, right? At Hall.
No, absolutely don't remember anything. I certainly don't think I was taken to another star system or even to Mars, and probably not to the moon. If anything did happen, I'm just guessing that if anything did happen, it would probably have been me being drugged and hypnotized to get more information. But if it's okay with you, I haven't gotten to the really scary part of my story.
Go right ahead. Okay.
Well, having originally plunked out of radar weapons control, even though I was getting good ratings now and doing well, I the Air Force tended to kick people out if they didn't make major below a certain time limit, like 14 years, they'd kick you out. And I was afraid that that would happen to me. I would spend a whole 14 years in the service and go to Vietnam and remote radar sites and whatnot and get kicked out. So I very reluctantly decided to leave the service. But I still had some slight faith in our government. And I wanted to make use of my security clearance and experience. So I applied by letter for a job as a civilian intelligence analyst with DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. And they simply ignored my letter, but at this time they hired another young officer, a fine young man, for the same job from our base, and he had a lower clearance than I had and had no intelligence background. And I knew the guy. He didn't have any ends. He didn't know anybody there. So I thought, well, this is a little strange, as well as being very disappointing. Well, right after that, a CIA recruiter was in town, and I went to see him about a job. And for once in my life, I actually made a good impression on someone. I don't know how. I really hit it off with this guy. And he said, of course, he couldn't promise anything. He's a recruiter. He's on a recruiting drive. They have multiple positions to fill. And he was recommending me for the job. I was highly qualified. He couldn't promise anything. The day after I saw him, I got this terse telegram from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, just loudly stating, we're not going to hire you. No reason given, just, we're not going to hire you.
Wow.
And the next day, the recruiter called me back and said, why haven't I heard back from you? And I told him about the telegram, and he said, oh, and that was the end of it. Now, think about this, as I was forced to think about it. There's no way that they're going to just shoot down somebody right away before he finishes recruiting drive and gives them all the names and recommendations, and then they make a decision. They're not going to write in the middle of it just somebody they've never seen, never heard of, and say, we're not going to hire this guy, whoever he is, we've never heard of him. There's only one horrifying explanation for this, and I realized it at the time. I mean, this is the first, up till then, I was very trusting. They had a file on me. I mean, there's no other explanation. It's crazy, but they had a file on me. They had my name on a list of undesirables. And I realized that right away, and then I connected that with that DIA business that they didn't hire me. But I thought, you know, how could they possibly have a file on me? I'm nothing. I'm nobody. I'm a little Shamil with a loser of a guy. Nobody's heard of me. How could this be? It was horrifying. And I tried to put this behind me. I got out of the service, mucked around in grad school, which is a waste. And finally, the only decent paying job I could get, because I'm good at taking tests and passing them, and back then they used objective tests, civil service. I got a job with the federal government's civilian agency, the Social Security Administration, which, by the way, is not what people think it is. It has some close liaison, I found out, with the CIA, and Social Security has files on virtually everybody in the country, so there's a little more to it than people realize. And I've been with Social Security a while, and I transferred into the Sacramento, California District Office, which is no longer in existence. It's all been reorganized years ago. In May of 75, and I'd been in Sacramento for a while, and they're transferred in over me. I was there first, and then he transferred in, just as I was at New Mexico State first, and then Major Cunningham transferred in after I was already there. A pattern there. They're transferred in over me, this generic management muck-a-muck. They were top-heavy with management. They had to invent jobs for him. GS-12, named Roland F. Clements, or F. Clements. I don't know if he's dead or alive now. He's, of course, long since retired. And he was kind of an odd individual, read a lot of science fiction, belonged to the Werner Erhard EST cult, one of those creepy cults from the 70s. And one day, he called me and my supervisor, Alex Sedano, and my union rep, Gloria Mattis, to a conference room, and accused me of illegally altering Social Security applications after they'd been signed, without having the client's initial the changes to show their approval. And he showed me a big stack of photocopies of documents. Well, I immediately saw that in every single case they had been illegally altered, but the handwriting was very blatantly and obviously not mine, nor any of the clients. And my union rep saw this right away. In other words, someone else in the administration, and it was perfectly obvious, and Clements had to have known about it, the handwriting was that obvious, had altered these documents. And yet he was trying to fire me, and he threatened me with going to prison. Threatened me with prison.
Incredible.
Using documents that he knew that someone else had offered, maybe himself or someone under his direction, or maybe someone for some relatively innocent reason. Well, we appealed, and they had to take that out of my file. But now I get to the scary part. I get to the real nightmare. It wasn't, I don't think, more than a few weeks after this incident with Clements that a friend of mine in the office, a guy named Bruce Walker, who was an airborne ranger and army chopper pilot in Vietnam, told me that Clements, the guy who had done that to me, had boasted to him that he, Clements, had once been a paratrooper in the Air Force. And I asked, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, Clements was in this tiny little Air Force Spec Ops unit whose members were trained to parachute on the crashed Soviet aircraft in North America. In other words, Clements, who tried to fire me using illegally altered documents, had belonged to the same tiny, tiny intelligence unit that Major Cunyon all those years before had been in.
Very interesting.
And I immediately, you know, I don't want to use hackneyed phrases like the earth pulled out from under your feet, you know, that sort of thing, but that's what it was like. It was like the beginning of a long nightmare because I instantly realized there's no way this is coincidence. Kevin Randall discovered that the unit never had more than about 130 officers and men. The U.S. population right now is over 300 million. You can do the math. And I realized there's no way this is a coincidence. It was horrifying. And I immediately drew a connection between this and my business with the CIA and DIA, and I realized somebody up there really hates me. But again, why? I'm nothing. I'm nobody. And I looked back at my life, and I said, is there anything that makes me stand out? And I remembered that experience at age 11. And for the first time, I realized that did resemble a UFO abduction. And then I realized that the unit trained and equipped to parachute on the crashed aircraft would be ideally suited to parachuting on the crashed UFOs if such existed, and the aircraft thing would be a perfect cover story. But
okay.
I had a problem. How did they know about my abduction? I hadn't told anyone. It was horrible. I mean, I knew something was wrong, but it didn't make sense even to me.
Okay, well, so, I got to stop right there because, I got to say, this is quite fascinating. When in this trajectory did you become the investigator on the Blue Book situation in the Air Force? Was it before or after?
That was back when I was still in the Air Force.
But that was before you went to the ROTC?
Well, I was in Air Force ROTC and graduated in 65 and entered active duty and was a UFO investigator for the Air Force in 66 and 67.
Okay, but see, because these incidents happened in what years? The thing in Sacramento with this guy.
Well, that would have been in 1975 that I came to Sacramento, and
sure.
This happened to me either 75 or 76.
So you have to look back also at the Blue Book time, in which you were actually recruited to be an investigator, right, to some degree.
Well, I asked for the intelligence career field, and they gave it to me, and.
But just because it's intelligence career does not mean you necessarily investigate UFOs, but you said it was part of your job description.
Right.
What happened was,
when I first went into intelligence, it was still intelligence responsibility. So we were doing the UFO investigations, and then we got the new regulation that changed it.
Well, it's very likely during that time that you were under surveillance and being, surveilled.
It's barely possible.
Under those conditions, and they probably spotted you as an abductee. As a matter of fact, they were given lists. Do you know that they were given lists of the abductees?
I couldn't hear you there. What was that last thing?
Do you know that they were given lists of abductees? That was supposed to be one of the things the Greys were supposed to do. They were supposed to give to the, MJ-12 or whatever, a list of the names of the abductees.
No, I hadn't heard that part. See, what I finally figured out might be the explanation is that they might just be tracking the families of potential abductees that may always
well,
run
they do that also. Yeah, they
so I hadn't heard the thing about the list. That's interesting. But
I came
up with a theory that they were tracking the families of potential abductees. It was like a couple of years after this before I figured that out. And then I started trying to tell everybody about it, the local MUFON, MUFON, Mutual UFO Network people in Sacramento, and I was interviewed by Boylan, Dr. Boylan, a couple of times. And
but
you need to go on break now, or I've got something else that's
coming up. No, we're actually very close.
Okay, late in 1992, I wrote a letter to the Air Force Record Center at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama asking them for information about the unit. And after a considerable delay, they replied that they had no record of such a unit. Now, you don't lose all records of an entire unit that was around for years. And it was very obvious that in late 1992, the government, talk about closing the barn door when the horses are out, was trying to classify the very existence of this unit. But get this, during the Cold War, Tunyon and Clements admitted having been in the unit and described it. They may have lied about its mission, but the existence of the unit was not a secret during the Cold War. Yet in 92, the Cold War is over, and they try to make it a secret. Obviously, it had nothing to do with the Cold War or Soviet aircraft. This is yet more evidence that it was a UFO unit. But, of course, Kevin Randall has established that anyway. Now, I need to tell you about UFO Magazine in Southern California, and don't worry, I'm not going to say anything that will get you sued. I'm not going to make any accusations against anyone. I'm just going to state the facts.
All right, thank you.
Late in 92, early 93, somewhere in there, I wrote just a letter to the editor of the UFO Magazine down in Southern California. Now, this is before William Burns was with it, you know. This is not at his doorstep. They didn't have to pay me for it or take responsibility for it. It would take up only a third of their precious space, detailing my experiences and my conclusion that they were tracking the families of abductees and that this was a UFO crash retrieval team. Now, up to now, nobody had talked about any Air Force crash retrieval team. I had not heard anyone up to that time talking about anything like that. I even included a copy of my DD-214 military discharge with my letter as at least some evidence, at least part of my story, was true. Not only did they not publish my letter, Don and Vicki Ecker called me long distance on the phone, both of them on the line at the same time, and interrogated me at great length, and then said they would not publish the letter to the editor because I had no proof. Since when did the UFO Magazine require proof for a letter to the editor? Plus, which I had some proof.
Wow.
But it gets even worse. Shortly after that, Kevin Randall's article on the unit came out in a now-defunct UFO Magazine published on the East Coast. At that point, I called the Eckers back, long distance. They were not in. I left a message. I said, I'm the guy you talked to. You better remember because it's so unusual calling me on the phone. And I told you all these things about this unit. And now Kevin Randall, very well-known, respected researcher, has come out and described the unit exactly as I had described it. If I were lying, or if I'm nuts, how did I know all about this unit before Kevin Randall's article came out? They never returned that call. The logical, response for them would have been to call me back, apologize, and ask me to write an article about it or something. Instead, no response. Now, I just want to point out that the late William Cooper, author of the book Behold the Pale Horse, made some sharp accusations against the Eckers. I won't repeat them. The question is, if those accusations were false, why did they never sue him? So I just feel something's a little wrong with this.
Okay.
Some years after this,
all right.
I was at a local MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, meeting in Sacramento, and our speaker was a lady with whom you're probably familiar, Melinda Leslie. And she told a story of having been abducted, telling it to Molson family members. And in her case, not only did the military know all about her abduction, they actually abducted her brazenly right off the streets and subjected her to what must have been frightening and humiliating examinations. And there are several other women, like Leah Haley, have come up with similar stories. Well, again, I was telling my story to the few people who had listened very few here in Sacramento years before Melinda Leslie was ever heard from. I could not have copied her story. I got no publicity. No one paid any attention. So she never heard of me and could not have copied my story. Why would two or more people come up with the same stupid, idiotic story? I mean, it sounds crazy to me. And I went through it. So that's the story. I mean, there's almost more than that. Things have kind of quieted down a little bit since then.
I understand. Well, fascinating, I have to say. And there's no doubt whatsoever that you were, you know, that you were targeted, that you were sort of watched. There's no doubt that they do record the families. I have heard that they were required to give lists to our military. And of course, we do know, and Melinda Leslie works in the area of my lab abductions at this time in her life. So clearly she was, sounds like she was kind of forcibly recruited in almost a certain sense. But, yes, and I, you know, fascinating background. So what, at this point, how did you come up with your book? Because you must have decided to do a great deal of research and then write for articles for these magazines and so on. In other words, you're something of a rebel. Would you classify yourself that way?
Yeah, I would call myself politically a patriot. We're all patriots are rebels now. that word patriot has undergone a lot of changes over the years, the meaning of it.
Sure.
And, well, the book came about for a whole lot of reasons. My experiences with this unit and these things that happened to me certainly is part of it. And like a lot of Americans, beginning with the Kennedy assassination, I began to feel that something terribly wrong was going on in our country. And for a long time, I was just kind of a mainstream government liberal, believe it or not. Then I kind of shifted to the right politically. And then I finally kind of went off the scale, kind of beyond right and left. I was learning more and more about the conspiracy. And as you probably know, once people start to study the conspiracies, and the one overarching conspiracy over all the others, once you go a certain distance down that path, and for most people, there's no turning back after a certain point. You just get sucked in further and further, you begin to learn more and more, and your mind gets more and more open. And maybe that has something to do, remember I said that I have the feeling now that those entities, whatever they were that abducted me, may have given me some knowledge or teaching. So gradually, I was reading all these conspiracy books and articles and thinking about things and pulling it all together, and I decided to write my own book. And it's a basic standard conspiracy book in a lot of ways. I mean, there's only one major conspiracy behind the others. And every writer, be it me or David Icke or anybody that writes about it, has to cover certain things through history. You know, the fiat money thing, the secret cults like the Masons and the Templars and the Rosicrucians and so forth, the Illuminati, that sort of thing. But what I did, it was a little different, is I was studying the evidence for the antiquity of the human species and the existence of prior cycles of civilization on our planet, indigenous human civilizations, before the current cycle that began about 5,500 years ago. And actually, since I wrote the book, a whole lot more has come to light about that. I mean, the evidence has just mounted amazingly fast. But I look back at the conspiracy, and it's an occult conspiracy. The people involved in it are into essentially black magic. And I developed the theory that perhaps the conspiracy in one form or another, and maybe even the cult of the organization behind it even, goes all the way back into ancient times and even beyond that in prehistory, into the prehistoric time during the last ice age that gave rise to the Atlantis legend. Now, regarding Atlantis, I was one of the first people, but not the first and the only one. I came up with the idea independently, but a number of people were thinking along these lines, to suggest that during the last ice age, at one point, sea levels were perhaps 400 feet lower than today. So much water was locked up in the ice caps, exposing vast areas of the continental shelves and various islands. The Bahamas and all that area would be it's one huge island, really. And there could have been civilizations out on those continental shelves and those islands at that time that would have been submerged at the end of the ice age when sea levels rose. There were a number of just very rapid and brutal climatic changes, which I've written about in some articles of Atlantis Rising as well. And I also got about over 85 articles on the web on various e-zines, you know, sites that function as online magazines. So I've covered this topic quite a bit. But that was my main theory, is that the conspiracy in one form or another, maybe even the organization behind it, may very well date back into prehistory.
Okay, but if you investigated, I guess we're going to go to a break here, and we'll be right back. I do have some more questions, and we will take questions from the audience, of which there are many. Thank you.
Okay.
This is Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and we are continuing our fascinating discussion with William Stecker. William, are you there?
Right, so here.
Okay, awesome. So right before the break, we were talking about the sort of how you got to determine that Atlantis might be sort of the source of a lot of sort of where the mystery maybe even began. And I'm just wondering how far along that trajectory did you go? Did you actually find what for yourself was some kind of evidence that made sense to you? And did you follow the trail also to the destruction of Atlantis and to Egypt, where a lot of Atlanteans went?
No, I just, the theory, the only reason I developed the theory at all, and that's all it is that, you know, you find that all the stories of Atlantis that Plato told is mentioned not only natural cataclysm, But he also mentioned that the Atlanteans had become morally degenerate, that they had this all-powerful empire. They wanted to conquer the world and have an empire. Well, it's kind of like the New World Order today. We've got this global elite, these banksters, whether you call them Illuminati or whatever, these banksters who want to have a one-world dictatorship. And you find it also in the flood legends, Judeo-Christian flood legend, the same thing. The world was given over to evil. At one point, they had the Tower of Babel and attempted at a central government and one language and so forth. And humanity destroyed in a great flood. And I just keep seeing these legends pop up over and over again, the same pattern, that there was this terrible evil that people had committed themselves to. And I developed the theory, and that's all it is, that there's some kind of a demonic Luciferian, or whatever you want to call it, cult, that still exists in one form or another, and that it's always been there. It wouldn't have the same name over time. It's certainly not the same people. People would die and new ones would take their place. And that they would have been in part responsible for the destruction of Atlantis, bringing it all on themselves. But that's all it is. It's just a theory.
Okay. Well, I have to say, I think your theory is quite accurate, but it sounds like you haven't been able to, and maybe it's just almost impossible to, you know, go out and get the evidence that pertains to Atlantis at this time. We're stuck with, with dealing with people that are, consider themselves psychic, who may feel they have contact and are given information about Atlantis. That's one way we get information about Atlantis. And then what some people might call downloads, et cetera. But in writing your book, you didn't feel that you were communicated with in any specific way to give you specific information about Atlantis then?
No, nothing like that. I just did a lot of research and thought about it and looked at patterns. I always feel that everything is in the patterns. Like you start talking about the face on Mars, the other structures on Mars and so on, it's just all in patterns.
Absolutely.
You look at this fact or that piece of evidence and dismiss it. But when you look at the overall pattern, then it becomes pretty clear. And in the case of the Atlantis thing, it's a pattern. It's not a really strong pattern that proves anything, but it's a pattern in giving a theory anyway.
Okay, so you have the link up to Atlantis, and you certainly seem to must have studied the occult to some degree, or understood something about what was going on. Did your trail take you through the Vatican and in that direction? In other words, what was your trajectory? How have you followed the trail?
Well, mainly I studied the works of other conspiracy authors, books and articles. And I've also studied history. One of my degrees is in history, and I read a lot of history. And I looked at the way today you have all these various weird little organizations like Skull and Bones. That's a charming symbol of death and destruction,
right,
and evil for them, the
uh-huh.
Bushes and everybody else in that. You have the Bohemian Club and Bohemian Grove.
Right.
I've been to the headquarters of the Bohemian Club in San Francisco. I walked right up to their door. And just as David Icke said, they had this crescent moon and this owl and the sign saying, "Weaving spiders come not here." I went there and saw that with my own eyes. And then I also looked at cults like the Masons, who pretend to be benevolent. And most Masons, like my brother and my grandfather, were Masons, for crying out loud. Most of them are quite benevolent, but you get up to higher levels and it's quite a different thing.
Right.
You look at some of the Freemason presidents we've had that have led this country into ruin. I mean, we've had some terrible Mason presidents, and you have to wonder about that. And then you have the Rosicrucians, which seem oddly linked with the Masons. All these different cults use a lot of the same symbols, the same signs, the same emblems, the same slogans. You find it over and over and over again, like the equal-armed cross, not the Christian cross, but an ancient symbol. The cross is much older than Christianity. All four arms of equal length, and it's a red cross. You find that with the Rosicrucians, or with the Templars, or the Masons. And the
sure.
whole thing about the Templars, they just spring out of nowhere, and the Knights Hospitallers, who had used a similar symbol, came about even earlier during the Crusades. They just pop up. Well,
okay,
nothing comes
out
of nowhere.
Did you, by chance, investigate the work of Jordan Maxwell?
I have read some of his stuff, and mostly I've talked to him a lot. You know, he
okay.
shows up at all the conferences, and he just loves to talk to people. You can just approach him anytime and talk to him at great length. And I always learn something. Or you'll find him, you know, in the hall there, surrounded by a crowd of people, and you can just walk up and listen. Nobody minds. And you can always learn something by listening to Jordan.
Okay.
He was one of the first people to research all this in great detail.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. You know, you've lived quite a while. You know, you're getting on in your years. And you have the background that you have. I assume that you were able to continue on and make a living somehow. But were you ever sort of approached by people that had information off, you know, whether they were, you know, what I would call whistleblowers or people in the military that had information to give you? Did any of those people ever come around to give you information?
No one ever gave me information. I had to be my own whistleblower as a result of those experiences I had. That's what gave me the clue that something really strange was going on, beyond strange. But no, I haven't had any whistleblowers come to me.
Really? Okay, that's interesting. So no contacts that brought you any information in sort of a unique way?
No.
Wow. So in terms of your book, where do you go with it? You obviously must start with Atlantis, and you go through up until let's imagine that you must deal with the various presidents and their link ups with the.
Absolutely. Yeah, I talked at great length about Teddy Roosevelt and Woody Wilson and what happened in 1913 with the Federal Reserve and so on. Now, one possible weakness in my book, or something people might find to criticize, is the fact that I published it in 2000, the year before 9/11, and I prophesied that our government would do a false flag operation much worse than Oklahoma City. Well, that was a no-brainer. I mean, I'm not the only one who saw that coming. I actually thought they would go directly to nuclear, chemical, or biological. I didn't perceive they were going to do the airliner thing into the World Trade Center, but I do believe it was false flag. But anyway, I wrote it during the Clinton regime. And I don't call them administrations anymore. They're all regimes. And up to that time, Clinton was the most obviously horrible president we've had. He wasn't the worst one, necessarily, but he was the most obvious about it. I mean, a clear-cut trail of bodies. If any normal person who wasn't president protected by the controlled media had all these bodies, Vince Foster, Mary Mahoney and her co-workers, Ron Brown and a whole plane load of people, two or three of his security guards, one of his aides back in Little Rock, all this trail of bodies. It was obvious to me that this guy was a monster. I mean, a freaking monster. And so I probably wrote too much of the book to talking about Clinton, and it's just that's where I stopped, because that's when they published it.
Oh, okay. So you're basically connecting the dots in that way. Have you ever been sort of aware of MJ-12 and the secret space program, et cetera?
I just gradually became aware of that when I first heard of MJ-12. And, of course, Stanton Friedman's done a lot of the research on that. Now, there's another great guy I've been privileged to meet a few times. You know, what I say about writing is that there's a lot of us out here who can write. Well, it's a large subculture of us who can write reasonably well. But what separates the groupies like me from the rock stars like Stan Friedman is the research. And this guy has really dug into this MJ-12. Now, it is possible that it is partly disinformation, but it would have to be awfully good disinformation to fool the guy as brilliant as Friedman. And there had to have been something like MJ-12. I mean, it stands to reason. I mean, you know, if the government, way back in 1963 when Cunyon appeared over me, at least as far back as 63, either had lists from the Greys or whatever of abductees, or was tracking the families of abductees, the implications of that are horrifying. That means our government knew all about UFOs and was obsessed by it. They knew about abductions before anyone had heard of abductions, because Cunha was over me in 1963. Nobody knew about abductions then, except the government. And this means that way back in 1953, the Air Force farm that UFO crash retrieval team. They almost certainly had some sort of ad hoc arrangement before that, but that's when it was formally constituted. Way back then, there had to have been something like MJ-12. As to the secret space program, I've just gradually, in the last couple of years, come really to suspect that the government has a secret space program. I mean, look at Townsend Brown's electrogravitics, and I I used to do a little TV show here in Sacramento, a little access show, and I interviewed a guy who built an electrogravity device, and, you know, I helped him assemble it in the studio, and then flew, and I seen him fly at the conferences. And I don't think it's accounted for by ion wind. I mean, I felt as close as I could with my hand to it without getting electrocuted, and there's such a slight breeze from it, and yet that thing lifts straight up. I just find it impossible to believe that the government does not have access to some sort of gravity control and other suppressed technologies that could have revolutionized our whole economy and made our lives better. Now, the extent of this secret space program, I don't know. I suspect very strongly that a lot of the real estate on the Moon and Mars may be already spoken for, and our government may not. We have been chased off the Moon. I mean, why did they stop at Apollo 17, for crying out loud? They already had the Saturn V's for the future missions. They'd already spent most of the money. The Saturn V's are the big-ticket item, and they were there, and they just quit. Now, something strange about all that. So I think we probably have a secret space program, but they're not telling us the truth about it. Now, one of the things that's in my book that I'm kind of proud of is when they did that tethered satellite shuttle mission back in 1999, they had a 7-mile-long tether with a weight on the end of it, and they announced they were going to use that to test if they could generate electricity. They have a closed circuit wires running down on the cable, and the spaceship is orbiting the Earth at almost 18,000 miles an hour with reverse magnetic
field. Are you talking about the STS footage?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not, even aside from the objects around there, we can, you know, people could debate forever if there was anything to those objects or not. I've heard all opinions. But I'm talking about the mission itself, aside from that.
All right.
They said they were using it to generate power. Okay, that's fine. But they didn't say why they suddenly needed so much power or why they didn't put up some solar cells or fuel cells. Fuel cells are solar cells. One or the other are both to generate the power. And I thought, well, if they generate power this way, they're converting the kinetic energy of the orbiting craft into electricity, which is going to slow the craft down and bring them down out of orbit. So they can only use it for power the last few minutes or so of the mission, the last hour maybe at the most. And then I thought, well, yeah, they need to come home. They want to deorbit. Normally, you would need a rocket burn. They could use this instead. And then I realized that if they could come down, slow down in orbit using this, they could put the cable in the other direction, put their solar cells up, and put them much towards the end of the cable and accelerate. And so I concluded in my book written in 2000 that they could have built a very low-thrust spacecraft using this weird form of electromagnetic propulsion, not to be confused with ion rockets or gravity control. And they could have used it to do manned and unmanned missions all over the inner solar system, gradually orbiting out and circling out further and further from the Earth under thrust, under very weak thrust. Nobody else said that but me. 5 years later, in 2005, in Discover Magazine, and in the fall 2005 issue of Scientific American, there appeared articles about how NASA was going to use tethered satellites and use solar cells to put electricity into cables to react with Earth's magnetic field and accelerate their satellites up to higher orbits. In other words, they said in Scientific American exactly what I said 5 years earlier. Exactly, in detail.
Sure. Okay, well,
so
then you can...
I myself over that one. But what that means is, why are they lying about it?
Well,
you know, why did the government lie at the time?
But also, if you were talking about it 5 years earlier, and you could come to that conclusion, being in your position, you can appreciate that they were already there and have been there for years before then. Okay, well, let me we have not got that much time left in this show, and they've got a lot of people have been very patient, want to ask you questions. I think we've also had a lot of callers. I'd like to invite the callers to call now. You'll be interested to know that we've got quite a large audience listening to you tonight, and that quite a few people were calling in. We weren't able to take those calls because you were right in the middle of telling me some of your story. But at this time, it would be great to take some of those calls if Revolution Radio would make that possible. And let me see. I'm supposed to maybe give the number, which is call-in number 347-688-2902. I guess that's the number you call. And then the name, I guess they're saying if you want to call in on Skype, you can put in Freedom Screen. Freedom Screen, S-C-R-E-E-N. Anyway, That's one way of doing it. Another way is to actually ask questions, and then I've got this wonderful individual behind the scenes who always collects my questions from the chat room, pastes them into a Skype message for me so that I don't have to hunt around. And I've got a whole list here. So, William, do you mind if I start going down these questions?
No, fine.
Okay. And believe me, I do have a few more of my own, so I'm gonna give these people a chance as well. All right, so here we go. Do you think that there'll be an announcement of UFO disclosure this year?
I think somebody's asking, is the government going to tell the truth about UFOs?
Right.
I have a problem with government and truth being in the same sentence. Anything the government announces, if they announce anything, count on it, it will be at least partly a lie and probably entirely a lie.
Yeah.
If they announce anything.
Okay.
The government
will
never tell us the truth.
You're a man after my own heart, I can tell you that. Okay, what does he say about the Horizontal Event Project?
Horizontal Event Project?
I don't know if they meant to say horizontal or if they actually mean horizontal event project.
No, I don't understand the question.
Well, it sounds like maybe that's a classified project that they're giving you.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard of anything like that.
Okay.
I know that Richard Hoagland has written about, and Michael Barra, in their book Dark Mission, had mentioned that NASA seems obsessed with Isis and Horus, and Horus is a god of the horizon. So there might be some connection there. I haven't heard anything like that.
Since you brought that up, do you believe that there is a potential for a return of the Anunnaki?
I don't know. I don't know what they are. You know, for a long time, I believe nuts and bolts UFOs, and I got really skeptical of that for a lot of reasons. And I started thinking they were paranormal. And I began to think that the whole abduction thing is paranormal and has something to do with intelligent design and evolution. But then I realized my own experiences indicate that there is some connection between actual nuts and bolts craft and abductions. So apparently there are some aliens out there. And, you know, one of the theories that I came up with, this is a possibility, okay, I'm not saying it's true. Suppose, since there were civilizations, I know there were, I'm just not sure how advanced or how early, indigenous human civilizations here on Earth, suppose that they went out, human beings like us, ages ago, thousands upon thousands of years ago, before the dawn of recorded history, and colonized Mars and the Moon, and it's our own distant relatives who are out there.
That's actually Hoagland. Hoagland likes to use that.
Hoagland originally had said that, you know, he put out the theory that maybe they're from another solar system, they colonized Mars. And then I talked to him about it quite a few years ago, and he was beginning to reconsider even then, consider this as a possibility. Because I'd already started thinking that possibility at that time. But that's just one possibility. More and more, I think, yeah, there's somebody out there, whether they're human or whether they're from another solar system. And, you know, they could have evolved on Mars itself. In fact, I've got in front of me right now the latest issue of Atlantis Rising with my article, True Mars. We've been lied to even about the atmospheric density on Mars. Even that.
Yes.
And I assemble a whole pattern of evidence showing that. Life, advanced life, definitely could have evolved on Mars, if you want to use the word evolved. And so there could be indigenous Martians. But something else I've written about, the planet Venus today is a hellhole. But look at it. It's got its total surface resurfaced during the last billion years, possibly during the last few million years. It was all melted. It rotates the wrong way, and it's got this dense atmosphere. All the above could be explained by one simple event, which does happen in our solar system, and that is an immense impact with a huge asteroid or planetesimal sometime in the last billion years that hit Venus, spun it around backward in its rotation around its axis, and melted the whole surface. Almost certainly something like that happened, because that's the explanation that works for everything. But that means that before that impact, it's possible even that Venus was livable. It could have been very different from what it is now, and at least in the polar and Arctic regions, it might have been habitable. So, you know, we could have aliens from another star system. We could have aliens from Mars. We could have aliens that originated on Venus or all of the above, or people from right here who moved to Mars and the Moon. There are just so many possibilities, and we don't really know.
Well, Right. But are you, you're aware of the work of Zachariah Sitchin, I assume?
Yes, I've never been able to dig through his books. There was too much in there that I found unbelievable. But on the other hand, what he, and also give credit even to Von Daniken, Ancient Astronauts, has done, he has looked at all these ancient myths, and it does look like somebody visited us in the past. You know, were they aliens from another planet, or were they actually paranormal entities? I don't know. But I think there is a grain of truth to what he says. I don't swallow this Nibiru thing. I just cannot handle that. I think that's absurd. But that doesn't mean he's wrong about everything, by any means.
Okay. Okay, now, why don't we take one of the people calling in, and I can continue to go down this list of questions as well from the chat room. But since we have a couple callers on the line, why don't we take one of those calls?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air with Carrie Cassidy and William Stecker.
Hello, Carrie and William. My name is George from Philadelphia.
Hi there.
Yeah, I'm very interested in all of this, as much of which has come from dreams that have actually been repressed for many, many years, and many of them are just coming out, you know, breaking through whatever psychic barriers which were in place from my youth till the present day, recurring dreams, recurring themes. I was discussing with some of the members of the chat rooms. He had mentioned something along, I'm not looking at the chat room now because I had to move away from the radio to, you know, due to the delay.
Right.
Called the etheric versus the dream. And I would have dreams where I was conversing with those beings we call the Greys, and from what I gathered, and I don't know if I'm interpreting it accurately, because they didn't quite communicate with me by way verbally as you and I are right now. It was more through like symbolism or symbology.
Right.
I'm not too clear on the differences between the two of those. But in any case, from what I've gleaned from these dreams, and whether they're just imaginative, they were imaginative dreams on my part or something real.
We're actually going to go to break very soon here. Do you have a question for our guest here?
Okay, a question. Okay. Would you lend credence to my notion that human life possibly or even probably originated upon Mars and was colonized here 65 million years ago or thereabouts, approximately around the time the dinosaurs went extinct, by way of an artificial asteroid filled with the amino acids and spores needed to start the human race over again from the beginning, as Mars was growing.
Okay, caller, I'm going to have to stop you right there, and we'll allow William Stecker to answer the question, and then we're going to go to break real quick here. William, did you hear the question, and
yes,
do you have an answer?
There's no way to know for sure, but, you know, the Martian meteorite showed that apparently there is life or has been life on Mars that is somewhat way similar to life here on Earth, and the DNA is similar. And so you could have had oil from the beginning, a seeding back and forth of the DNA, so that life here might be similar to life there. And for all we know, maybe somebody did come here from there.
Well,
it's just impossible to prove or disprove.
I can tell you both Bariska, if you want to hear our video interview with Bariska, the boy from Mars is what he's called. At 7 years old, even when he was younger, he just started having total recall of his life, his previous life on Mars. And he was there before he came to Earth. We're about to go to break. We have another caller, so I'm going to let that caller go, and thank you, caller, for calling in.
Thank you for the time. I'll relay some more questions along the website, and if they can be answered, they can be answered.
Great. Okay, thank
more
you.
More particularly the Venus thing.
I hear you. Okay, put them in the chat room, and we'll try to answer them. So is there another caller hanging on still, or have we lost that caller?
Yes, 856.
Okay.
Well, there's the break
We're going to have to go to the break, so we'll take the next caller at the after the break. Thank you.
right here.
Okay, awesome. Let me ask you this. I've got several people sort of asking about various things to do with the history of UFOs, et cetera, et cetera. Where are you at right now, you know, mentally in terms of what you think is happening? Do you think that the United States is on the verge of a revolution? I hear you say you're a patriot. And do you think that there is something behind the powers that be such that, you know, in other words, if you know this background that comes all the way from Atlantis, do you think they're going to stand down easily? Do you think that there is a battle to be had? What's your point of view on that?
I'm very pessimistic. We certainly face, at some point, some level of economic collapse and a very complex civil war inside the country with different factions and races pitted against each other. The elites like to divide and conquer. And, you know, people who came to power through centuries of torture and mass murder, they're not going to just roll over quietly. I don't know how bad things are going to get, but they're going to get a lot worse before they get better, and we're not going to settle this peacefully.
Okay.
I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I'm not looking forward to it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Very sober words, but I do appreciate them. Now, I believe we have one more caller holding on, at least. Is the caller there?
Yes. Hey, Carrie, it's Jared.
Hi there. And you are on the air with William Stecker and myself.
Yeah. I was wondering what you thought about Atlantis being the world before the flood of Noah and, like, the fallen angels creating that. So I looked into the books of Jasher and Enoch, and Jasher even says that these fallen angels even mixed animals to pervert God and all this genetic stuff that we're doing. I was wondering if you looked into either of them, Jasher or Enoch.
I've read a lot of that stuff in recent years. I do believe that Atlantis and the flood legends are one and the same. They're all referring to the end of the last ice age, which included not only a sudden overall rise in sea levels over a considerable period, but also very sudden events of massive tsunamis when glacial meltwater lakes broke through ice dams and flooded into the ocean, created sudden rises and tsunamis, very catastrophic events. And you look at all the legends, and they all seem to indicate that the people of Atlantis, the people of that period, were given over to some pretty dark arts and some pretty evil practices. And now it looks like we're seeing that same pattern again. Yeah, and all this genetic experimentation that's going on is beginning to look more and more sinister all the time. And I'm beginning to think there probably is something to some of these ancient stories. And it does look like it's happening again. I can't be certain of that, but it sure looks that way.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, caller. Okay, we've got some more questions here, William, and I'm going to go down the list if you don't mind. And, of course, if you have something to say, even, you know, that pertains to the questions or not, just speak up and let me know.
Okay.
Okay. Someone wants to know if you're saying Greek and Roman sources are the sources for your history. It sounds like you use all kinds of sources, but you want to answer that?
Well, I use a great many sources, yeah. I certainly didn't go back and read documents in Latin or Greek. I don't have any facility of those particular languages. But I studied a whole lot of different historical accounts, and certainly I go back to the ancient Roman and Greek periods and ancient Egypt and so on. Anyone writing about the conspiracy has to cover it from a historical point of view because it is unfolded historically over time.
Right. Well, along those lines, let me ask you if you think that the current administration, current state of the United States is a lot like the fall of Rome.
Yeah, you know, not a lot of people point that out, and it sure is true. Even they're letting barbarians into their country. We got wide open borders. You know, we're letting people in from all over the place and flooding us. They had the massive spending. They had the corruption. They were importing all their foodstuffs and everything else for a long period of time. They cut down their productivity and were importing and were doing the same thing. At one point during the Republic, the Romans had a whole lot of small farmers. They were all drafted in the army for various wars. And while they were away at war, the rich landowners took over their farms, took over everything, and started using slaves to run everything. it is so similar to what's happening here with the loss of small businesses and family farms and the little guys getting swallowed up by huge corporations and run by the banksters with their fiat money. It just, the parallels are just really scary.
I would say so. And there's another parallel, of course, in history, and that's Nazi Germany. I'm seeing all kinds of bell ringers there. What about you?
Well, you know, it's been pointed out by Jim Mars and Joseph Farrell and others that it looks like rather than our beating the Nazis, it almost looks as if they've taken over here. You know, people think, you know, communism is on the left and Nazis are right wing, but Nazi is national socialist. And Hitler's early life, he was your classic hippie, beatnik, bohemian type guy, the classic type who becomes a left winger. Mussolini, the Italian fascist, had been a socialist all his life, and actually he was a communist because he believed in revolutionary socialism. So it's all one thing. You call it communism, fascism, Nazism. Whatever you call it, it's one thing. I use the term fascism. And yes, we are very similar, more and more all the time, to similar to Nazi Germany.
I think that there are some indicators that also that we're actually sort of right on the verge. If you remember the time when people were leaving, at least I get echoes of it, the time right before, you know, sort of the doors closed in Nazi Germany and you couldn't get away anymore, when people were sort of warned and some people left and some people took the warnings and some people didn't.
Yeah, of course, there's no place for us to run to now. The whole world is coming under the control.
Well, exactly. And that's a whole interesting discussion, actually. And I do believe that the Nazis basically came on board here and meant that they are part of the ruling class at this time. Project Paperclip, I'm sure you're aware of that history, right?
Well, very much so. And a lot of those people that were portrayed to us as just kindly old German scientists, a lot of them were hardcore Nazis. Werner von Braun was a very sinister individual, and he certainly knew of the concentration camp and the conditions of the inmates and made no effort to do anything about it. I don't know if there's anything he could have done, but some of those scientists were actually directly involved in the use of the prisoners' labor and were indirectly involved in their mistreatment and brutality. These were not nice people.
Okay, when you say Werner von Braun was a sinister guy, what do you base that on? Do you have how did you, you know, get that information?
Well, he was actually in the SS, you know. Now, that doesn't necessarily
sure.
mean that he favored everything they did. But, you can look at it and say, well, he's just a scientist who wanted to travel in space, and he was drafted by his government. If he refused to work for him, he'd probably be shot. And, you know, you can even understand that ordinary Germans would have believed in their war because, after all, we were firebombing German cities, killing civilians. We weren't quite the good guys we pretended to be. And we were allied with Joe Stalin, who was even a worse mass murderer than Hitler. But there's a little more to it than that. But von Braun is just there's just something about the guy that is always kind of creeped me out. If you look at pictures of him, at the time of surrender, it's this happy smirk on his face, this kind of superior look. That's not much to go on, I realize, but it's just a whole pattern of this guy. I'm very mistrustful of him. But it doesn't matter. He's gone now.
Oh, well, yes. I just wondered if you had any sort of more specific information,
He was SS, and he did know that they were using concentration camp labor to build the V-2s.
I've just always felt that the information about him that has been kept under wraps, that I feel that we've never really gotten the real information on who he was, on what he really knew.
And them and the others, too.
Yeah, and there are probably some others as well. Okay, let me see. We've got some more questions here. A person wants to know about Project Southern Cross. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't know anything about it. I've never heard the term.
Okay. Do you happen to think that the U.S. Will interfere with China trying to go to the moon?
No, I don't think we will. We give them or sell them a lot of their technology. Bill Clinton sold them technology for campaign contributions indirectly. And the current regime has continued the practice. We've aided and abetted the Chinese communists from day one.
Yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy. They're also massing, I don't know if you've heard, on the border of Mexico, from what I understand, with troops.
Well, true stories. You can never quite track it down.
Well, I've got somebody who is on the ground in Mexico who is a trustworthy source and has said that they are there. Okay, let's see. Do you think we're going to have access to free technology anytime soon?
You mean like free energy technology, probably?
Yeah, other advanced technology. That's the question.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people privately out there. There's a lady named Jean Manning who writes a regular column for Atlantis Rising, who writes about alternative energy, you know, coal fusion, and even more exotic things like the Howard Johnson magnet motor and so on. You know, somewhere in there, there's a grain of truth. I know for a fact that coal fusion does produce excess energy, and it's never been explained. So the knowledge is there, and of course the government is going to do everything in their power to prevent our developing either our domestic oil and gas supplies or these alternative energy sources. But there are individuals, private individuals out there trying to develop this stuff. So I think at this point anything might happen. Keep our eyes and our minds open. Anything could happen at this point.
Okay. Some people have, there have been rumors going around that supposedly that the reptilians have been removed from Earth. First of all, I mean, I have to say that I think that's total BS. There's no way they're going to abandon the place that they want to take over. What is your point of view on this?
Well, I don't know for certain if there are reptilians. I suspect there might be. There have been so many different people. It's not just David Icke. You know, it's a whole lot of people have reported this in conjunction with UFOs. And there are people reported seeing him out in the woods along with Bigfoot. There's something to that. There's a grain of truth in there. But if they are here, if some of these beings are reptilians, no, I don't think they're about to leave. It's not going to be that easy. Nothing's going to be easy from now on.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let me ask you this, because it sounds like you were really tracked and sort of followed around in a certain way in your life up to a certain point. Do you feel that eased off at a certain age, or do you think that they're still interfering with you?
I don't feel like I'm interfered with. I know that I'm on their enemies list, but I'm pretty far down on it, so you've got bigger fish to fry. But I haven't been bothered in quite a while. Nothing much has happened. I did have one odd thing happen maybe a year or so ago. You know, I read all these articles for the Internet, over 85 of the last few years, and sites based all over the world. And I was having breakfast, and I get up early, and there's a knock on the door. And there was this tall young man with a foreign accent. I took him at first to be German or Swedish. But he said he was Russian, and he gave some name, which wasn't his name. It was like an American name. I forget what it was, Mike or something. And he said he'd been reading my articles on the web on these various sites and wanted to talk to me about leading a demonstration in Washington, D.C. to try to change the government. And we talked about that for a while. But the funny thing about the guy was he just appeared out of nowhere. I live on a dead-end street, and he just came walking up with a big leather bag under his arm with all his worldly goods, I guess, in there. Didn't look homeless, clean, neat, you know, guy. No car, nothing. No explanation of how he survived or where he came from, and then he went away. Next day I was out working in the garden, he came and talked to me some more, and then went away. And I always thought that was a little strange, but other than that, I haven't had anything too creepy happen in quite a while.
Okay, well, what about dreams? Do you have any kind of sort of contact with other worlds?
I've had seemingly paranormal experiences all my life. They're characterized by tremendous variety, apparent out-of-the-body experiences and so on. I can never be quite certain, is this experience real or not? But I've had some experiences of paranormal shared with other people, like an experience with animal mutilations and the mysterious cookie-cutter hole in the ground southwest of Mount Diablo that I and about 11 or 12 other people witnessed. And just a whole variety of experiences. And I've always had strange dreams, usually not involving UFOs, though. Example, I had one dream where I was flying in this tower, and I went up to a room in the tower with big windows, and there was an old man hunched over a bunch of documents and ancient scrolls, and I had this weird feeling that I was in Austria in the Middle Ages, and it was like this guy had summoned the spirit, and I was it. but he didn't see me, and I flew out the window and flew around over a beautiful landscape. And he always left wondering, is this just a dream, or some dreams a little more? And I don't know. But I've always had a tremendous variety of strange experiences, and these continue right up to the present time, not as pronounced as they were a few years ago, perhaps.
Okay, very interesting. All right, let's see. What about the Stargates? Are you aware of the Stargates? Have you had any information come to you in that regard?
No, I've heard of them, but I don't know much about it. I haven't had anything, you know, come to me directly.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Did you have kids?
Did I what?
Did you have kids in your life?
My first wife and I had a daughter, yeah.
Okay. But did you have a feeling that your child was abducted?
No, I never knew. She never really cared about me a whole lot. And then when my wife left me and divorced me, she eventually turned my daughter against me, and she refused ever to see me again. I haven't seen her since she was 15. She's 31 now. She's still alive.
Oh, my God. Okay.
This is all a rather sad thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get too personal there. The reason I was asking is, as you say, they target families.
Right. And, I know. And I would like to have known if she ever had an experience like that. I remember once she mentioned a dream that she'd had, that a door opened in the wall where there wasn't a door and a witch came through. And whether that's significant or not, I'm not certain. And, of course, at the other end, I'm adopted, so I don't know very much about my natural birth parents.
Oh, really?
I was adopted way back in 1944, so I'm a bit of a mystery to myself.
Okay, well, that is interesting because, you know, another thing that goes on, of course, with the Illuminati is they track bloodlines.
I know they track the bloodlines. That's what my theory was about the UFO victims. In fact, I believe there's certain, I built a theory that during the normal sleep-wake cycle, a lot of people sometimes go, you might say, sideways in consciousness to an altered state. Instead of going up to being awake or down to being asleep, they go sideways and look at reality from a different angle and see the paranormal side of reality. And in that state, they become visible to and somewhat vulnerable to entities from the other side, so to speak. And I think that this is more common in certain bloodlines, and that the Illuminati are such bloodlines, given over to the dark side of the force, so to speak, from childhood, but that others of us also belong to similar, perhaps even related bloodlines. Perhaps we're even related to the Illuminati. But, of course, it's like princes back in ancient times might want to murder his father and his brother to get power. And so the Illuminati would consider us potential enemies. They might consider us potentially useful, but also potentially enemies, and they'd have to keep an eye on us. And I think something like that is going on. And I believe in intelligent design and evolution, and I believe that there's more to genetics, to heredity, than just the physical aspect. I think there is a paranormal or a psychic aspect when a child is conceived. There's something else going on there.
Okay.
And maybe this part of it carries the psychic tendencies.
Absolutely. Are you aware of sort of the distinction between, let's say, blue eyes, green eyes, and, you know, the difference in hybrids, what they consider to be hybrids? And have you heard of the work of Graham Hancock and the recent work that talks about how the gene for red hair came from the Neanderthal line, and that's something that is very coveted by the Illuminati?
I had red hair as a child. It gradually turned brown, and now it's white, what they left of it. I had very red hair as a child, and I remember we lived for a time. I mostly grew up in Houston, but we lived for a time in South Texas, and we went to Mexico quite often. And the Indians would reach out to rub my head, which really freaked me out. I was just a little kid. But my dad thought it was a joke.
He was like, and you must have blue eyes.
They rubbed my hair
as well
for good luck, because red hair brought good luck, and you find them all over. So I had red hair. That would be from my natural mother. My natural father, I know he was a Jewish guy, but I don't know anything else about him.
Okay, but are your eyes blue?
My eyes are kind of a gray, green, hazel color.
I hate to break in, but we've had a caller sitting for about 15 minutes.
All right. Thank you very much. Sorry about that. Go right ahead, caller. Ask your question.
Is this me? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Awesome. Hey, this is Brian from the chat room. Everybody, Carrie, love the show, first off. I just wanted to ask if you were familiar with Ben Fulford at all? I'm sorry, Will
what?
Is the name, right? Benjamin Fulford?
Fulford. The name sounds familiar, but I can't quite place it. It just sounds vaguely familiar to me.
Okay. I just wanted to ask your question, or somebody asked a question earlier, and your answer was about the UFO government disclosure, and you said that they would be lies. But I'm not trying to throw accusations out there, but it kind of just sounded like it was an avoidance of the question, and I just wanted to know if you had any info at all regarding the people of Earth finally being contacted by the celestial beings, and whether it will be within 4 weeks this spring or this year.
Well, I don't have any access to any special information like that one way or the other. Nothing would surprise me at this point as to these beings themselves contacting us or not contacting us. I just don't trust the government. But I don't have any knowledge of that one way or the other. I wish I could.
All right.
I don't.
Okay. Carrie, if I could, just add one more question.
Sure.
All right, great. Thank you so much. I was wondering if you had any knowledge about, like, Egyptian mythology and stuff like that.
Just a slight knowledge of it. I'm by no means an expert. I know that NASA, according to Richard Hoagland and Mike Barron, they make a strong case for this in Dark Mission. I know that NASA is obsessed by the whole Isis, Horus, Osiris myth, that whole story. They're obsessed by it. And I think Hoagland and Barron have made their case pretty strongly.
Right. And, well, I have to say that the reason they're obsessed with it is because it has to do with the return of Horus, and who is an Anunnaki. And for more information on that, you can read one of Andy Lloyd's books that are actually novelistic renditions of what the return of Horus might look like. And there's even potentially a possibility that that's who they worship when they go to Bohemian Grove, etc. It's not just the devil, it's actually Horus himself.
Okay, that answers my question pretty much. All right, great, thanks a lot. Appreciate you having me on.
Okay, thank you. We are getting very close to the end of the show here, William, and I really appreciate you being so patient and coming forth with so much of your own personal background and, you know, revelations and things you've been through. I think people are very touched by hearing this information and how you relate it, and I think it's of great value. Do you have anything that you'd like to touch on before we end the show here?
No, I think I pretty well covered it. If people want to find out more about some of the things I thought about or researched, my articles are available at Atlantis Rising. You can get back issues, articles from back issues off the web, and the magazine itself is for sale. My book can be gotten directly from my publisher, the best, latest, most protected version of my book, from Hidden Mysteries. That's one word, hiddenmysteries.com. That's the publisher, that because I self-publish and I had to go back and correct typos and correct things and prove things, and that's the most protected version.
Okay. Well,
and then I have my articles on the web that are all over the place.
Wonderful. And, well, let me just say this, that I think your background is quite fascinating. I do believe there's still information there that you could uncover if you ever get a chance to be regressed. It would be fascinating for you to learn more, and if you do come across more information, I'd love you to get in touch with me. I also encourage you to watch some of the Project Camelot interviews. I think you would relate to quite a few of the people that I've interviewed in the past, and I do want to know if you've ever met Bob Dean.
Bob who?
Bob Dean.
Oh, Bob Dean.
Robert. Yeah, Bob Dean.
He wouldn't hardly speak to me. He was busy talking to somebody else. I tried to talk to him. He was nice enough. He was talking to somebody else. What's really funny, he was interviewed in my hotel room down in Santa Clara at one of the conferences. A friend of mine who does Access Television, or used to do Access Television in Sacramento, and I worked on his shows and hosted one myself, interviewed Bob Dean and his wife in my hotel room. Very, very strange story.
Very interesting.
So the, Bob Dean seems like an honorable, decent man. I've seen him many times, his talks. Whether his story is true or whether he was fed this information and used, I don't know. We have to always be a little bit wary of that. You know, you can have an honest, decent guy and an intelligent guy, but anybody could be fooled, and they could be fed information that isn't good. So
okay.
I don't know. I don't know whether the story is accurate or not.
All right. Well, thank you.
On here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. I do think it's very important to sort of stay in the mind of the observer on a certain level at all times. Here in this sort of Maya, this matrix that we're all a part of, and keep a sort of an open mind at the same time. So thank you so much, William Stecker, for coming
on
the show.
Thank you for having me on the program. It's very decent of you to have me on there.
Absolutely. Well, I've really enjoyed it, and I think that the listeners have as well. So I think that we've covered most of the questions that came across the board here, and I don't think... I'm trying to see just where we are in terms of timing, so if they can give me an indicator. Otherwise, at this point, I guess I want to thank everyone for listening. I do want to remind you that I am doing a live stream with a nuclear physicist from Iran who is now living in Belgium and dealing with free energy technologies, plasma reactors, and we're going to be talking about all of that next Wednesday in the morning at 11 a.m., and then in the evening I will be doing my regular show on American Freedom Radio, and we will be talking about Bigfoot and someone who deals with him quite often, and I believe his name is Thomas Hughes. I don't have my schedule in front of me here. And let's see. I'm not sure what they're trying to tell me here. So I guess I want to thank everyone, and I guess if you go in and you want to support Revolution Radio, you can be a sponsor. You can I guess the show itself will become available after the fact, and they will give me a copy. But if you want to subscribe and help support their archives and so on, they do sort of rely on donations to stay alive over here in Revolution Radio as well. So thank you again, William Stecker. Fascinating background. I think there's a lot more going on with you than you've even revealed here, and I'd love to hear more about that in the future. Thank you, everyone. Good night, and have a great weekend.
Okay, folks, please visit our new site. It's www.alwaysreadytogo.com, and it has the latest survival information and stuff from Nighthawk and Ghost Walker. Thank you for tuning in tonight.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Join us every Sunday night at 10 p.m.